I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it an American conversation with global attitude. In several rounds recently about Cuba, this is a historical digression on the eternal question of who killed JFK, which may be getting closer to its eternal answer with Cuba at the core. Our guest, David Kaiser, says it was Lee Harvey Oswald and a diversified army of conspirators who killed the president. But what killed him was the convergence of two passionate public campaigns of the late 1950s and early 60s, one by the mobbed-up Kennedy brothers, John and Robert, to crush organized crime in America. That's an odd one. The other big force here from the Eisenhower and Kennedy administrations was to eliminate Fidel Castro and communism from Cuba by virtually any means necessary, including assassination by American mobsters, of all people. Lee Harvey Oswald, in David Kaiser's telling, was a multi-purpose assassin that the CIA had a hand in recruiting. He might have shot Castro before he ended up shooting Kennedy, but he seems in the event to have been working the mob's plan, and it was the mob's man, Jack Ruby, who shot Oswald in Dallas police custody to shut him up. David Kaiser is a much-praised author and historian at the Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island. Harvard University Press has just published his book called The Road to Dallas, The Assassination of John F. Kennedy. David Kaiser, welcome to Open Source. You read and reassembled a mountain of evidence in this case. How did you come to your judgment, and is this the one that will stick?
Well, first of all, Chris, I do have to correct one thing you said.
Go ahead.
I did not definitely say in the book that the CIA had a hand in recruiting Lee Harvey Oswald. I think it is an open question.
They knew him? They cultivated him?
No, we do not know that. They debriefed him indirectly after he came back from the Soviet Union through George Demoranshield, a private citizen who became a friend of his. Whether Oswald went to the Soviet Union, as did a number of other ex-servicemen at the same time who stayed a couple of years and came back on behalf of the CIA, I don't know. I think it's possible, but I don't know. Nor do I think there is anything like conclusive evidence that Oswald was working actively for the CIA at the time of the assassination, although there is one story that suggests that he was in contact with a major CIA agent. And I do not think that the CIA had a direct role in the assassination.
Fair enough. We'll come back to the CIA question.
But you asked me how I got going. Well, I got going the way tens of millions of Americans my age and older did on the evening of the 22nd in 1963. And in fact, I remember hearing on that evening on my local radio station the tape of Oswald's radio debate in New Orleans in which he was supposedly defending Fidel Castro and thinking, isn't this amazing? Here this man has just killed the president and we're hearing this just a few hours later. Now, I think that the key development for me about this intellectually, as with so many other people, was in the mid-70s when we began to learn about CIA skullduggery, when we learned about the assassination plots against Castro, and a lot of surrounding events, and when I began to wonder, believing already that Oswald actually had killed the president, is all this connected in some way? And the Church Committee tried to look into that. And then came the House Assassinations Committee in the late 70s, which did reach the conclusion that the assassination was probably a conspiracy involving organized crime figures. And I was very impressed by that. And it was a few years after that, in 1983, that I wrote my first piece on the case for the Sunday Outlook section of the Washington Post. Then, in the mid-90s, and because of Oliver Stone's movie, although I don't like the movie, this was an excellent consequence of it, the Congress, led by Senator Kerry, passed a law mandating the release of all JFK records. And that law has been largely, although not totally, I regret to say, complied with.
So suddenly there's a huge trove for the historians. I keep wondering, where have they been?
And, yes.
And then what of real new usefulness did you find in there?
Well, I found an enormous amount. both about the actual investigation of Oswald and Ruby, reading the original FBI files, but far more about the Robert Kennedy Justice Department campaign against organized crime, and above all about what the CIA was doing. As soon as I knew those documents were released, I was determined to go through them. I was confident that I would find more, and I did. I also was able to develop a new way to do research and to record research using Microsoft Excel, which I think was a huge breakthrough, which I hope I can pass on to other historians, although so far I haven't found much of a market for that. Well, basically, it's like using note cards, except that your note card is a row of a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet. And in the row, in various columns, you identify what the document is, you identify when it was written, you identify the subject of the document, and then you have a box in which I would summarize the contents of the document, perhaps quote from it some, just the way I would in a note card. Now, the beauty of this is as follows, and I'll give you an example. The FBI file on the original Oswald investigation, it's put together at headquarters as documents come in. So you're getting documents on a dozen different subjects as you read through the file. You have documents on Oswald's Marine Corps service. You have documents about his time in New Orleans. You have documents about his time in Dallas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you have put a heading and a subhead for the subject of the documents, when you're through, all you need to do is hit a quick sort button, and then you have all the documents relevant to a particular subject right there in order, sort them again by date, and you're ready to write. And actually, in the end, when I was writing the book, the most beautiful thing about it that I discovered was that there's something called a concatenate command in Microsoft Excel, which would actually make the footnote for me. So I could just lift the footnote out of Excel and put it in the manuscript. So that is how, I think, one historian, with some help from a team of undergraduate college students led by my own son, could make significant advances over the work of an entire House committee staff. Also because I had more time to think than they did. They were under terrible time pressure.
David Kaiser, what was the new concatenation that nails your theory, most particularly against the venerable lone assassin, single nut theory of Lee Harvey Oswald?
Well, there are two really critical pieces of evidence that clinch it, in my view, although there's a tremendous amount of circumstantial evidence. What I found was that there was a large network involving any Castro elements, mobsters. Some elements of this network were patronized by the CIA. Some were not. They were busy organizing mob plots against Castro. They were busy trying to discredit Castro around the country. In 1963, they were very concerned about two possibilities: one, that the Kennedy administration would never do anything about Castro, or two, that the Kennedy administration would replace Castro, but that they would replace him with someone who they regarded as just as bad. Mm. Now, one figure deeply involved in this network and who actually had a long-standing relationship with one of the key mobsters, Sandro Trafficante of Florida, was a man named Loren Hall, a former serviceman, who had been traveling around the country involved in various schemes. Now, we cut to Dallas in late September of 1963 when a Cuban refugee, a woman named Sylvia Odio, gets a visit, as she explained to the FBI in December of 1963, from three men, two of them speaking Spanish and claiming to be Cubans, although she doubted that, actually. She thought they were Mexicans, and one American. And the main Cuban calls himself Leopoldo. The American is introduced as Leon and doesn't say much. Now, Leopoldo tries to pump her initially about any Castro activities in Dallas and about whether she can help them with various projects. But a couple of days later, he calls her and he says, "What did you think of the American?" She says, "Well, I didn't think anything." And Leopoldo says, "Well, he's a very interesting guy. He used to be in the Marines. He's a great shot. He's the kind of guy, if we could get him into Cuba with the underground, he could take a shot at Fidel." He said, "Boy, I'll bet you Cubans wanted to kill Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs." And as she explained months later to the Warren Commission, she refused to be drawn into this and wasn't interested. But as soon as she saw Oswald on television on the 22nd, she realized that it was him and actually had a nervous collapse. Now, that is the first thing that links Oswald to this whole network, which was involved in assassination attempts against Castro. Some of them in cooperation with the CIA, and within that crowd, we have much evidence of lots of talk about assassinating the president. The second key point has to do with a mobster named John Martino, a Traficante associate who had actually been in prison in Cuba from 1959 to 1962. And there's a lot about him in the files and his activities in anti-Castro plots. But the clincher came from his son, who was 17 at the time. He has a PhD in psychology. He's a very impressive guy who I've talked to on the phone at length, and who has now published this and talked to me about it, that a couple of weeks before the assassination, he and his family were sitting at the dinner table watching the evening news, either Huntley Brinkley or Cronkite. And there was a reference to the president's forthcoming trip to Texas. And his father said, if he goes to Dallas, they're going to kill him. And on the 22nd, on the morning of the 22nd, his father said to him, Edward, I don't think you're feeling well today. I think you ought to stay home from school, and I'm going to be out in the garage. And if there's any news, come out and tell me. So at around 1:30, 1:45, 2 o'clock Eastern time, there was news. He did go out and tell him. His father simply nodded. Then his father came back in the house and began making a series of phone calls all over the country, starting a campaign, which is very well documented, to try to prove that Fidel Castro was behind the assassination. Martino died in 1975, and in the last year of his life, he told two close friends that he was involved in the assassination.
The Odio incident, yes, and yours is the most complete account I've ever read of it, establishes that Lee Harvey Oswald, if it was him, was a all-purpose gunman. He could take out Fidel. He could take out JFK. Is this a psychopathic shooter, or could these two killings have been part of a single scheme?
Well, there were plenty of people who would just as gladly have shot Fidel as JFK. And in fact, somebody raised that question in a presentation I gave at that once. Does it really make sense that somebody would want to kill Castro or JFK? And there was a Cuban-American friend of mine in the room who had grown up in Miami, and he immediately exclaimed, I can certainly vouch for that one. I think Oswald is the most enigmatic individual I have ever studied. He was a violent individual. He was a very secretive individual. What is so frightening about him is the way he kept all his appetites under control. A friend of mine says, I don't trust a man with no vices. Well, Oswald didn't smoke. He didn't drink. He wasn't interested in food. He apparently wasn't very interested in sex. And he could walk around with a pretty calm exterior for the most part. But he had been violent since he was a kid. And, well, he proved what he was capable of on November 22nd. He had also taken the shot at General Walker, although there's a serious question in my mind, which will never be resolved, as to whether he was trying to actually hit Walker or not. Actually, there is an internal memo in the Warren Commission, which is based on the Odio incident, in which a staffer wrote, this is a paraphrase, but a pretty close one, perhaps some anti-Castro Cubans met Oswald and realized his potential for violence. And I think that was an insightful remark. But I don't want to try to get too far inside the head of a man who's been dead for 45 years and who was an extremely difficult person to know.
David Kaiser, in your view, what's the best alternative theory out there? Vincent Bugliosi, former prosecutor, is out with a book not so long ago affirming the single assassin idea, dumping on the whole notion of conspiracy. Who else do you respect out there?
Oh, I respect two kinds of people. There are several who developed the broad outlines of this before I did, led by Bob Blakey, G. Robert Blakey, yes, who was in the Kennedy Justice Department fighting organized crime, who played a large part in writing the RICO Act and who became the chief counsel of the Assassinations Committee. There are other people who have written about the organized crime aspects of the case. The problem that we have which has made it so hard for the average American to get a grasp on this, is that from the beginning, the discussion has been dominated by two opposing extreme views which are held by their adherents with religious fervor. The first, the total lone assassin view, which is really the double lone assassin view, because its adherents, like Bugliosi, have to argue that both Oswald and Jack Ruby, who killed Oswald, committed these crimes totally for their own reasons, without reference to anything else. And in Ruby's case, that is far more, that is even more ridiculous than in the case of Oswald. And those people Bugliosi is interesting. Bugliosi, for instance, believes that Oswald was at Silvio Odio's house, and I was very impressed that he allowed himself to be swayed by the evidence on that point. At the same time, because he doesn't realize who Lorne Hall was, because he hadn't investigated the broader background, he's able to dismiss it as having no significance. But most of those people, and Gerald Posner is certainly in this group too, who wrote a bestseller 15 years ago, Taking the Lone Assassin View, insist that any evidence tending to show a conspiracy has to be false, and that anyone who even opens the door to that is suspect. And on the other side, you have what I call the grand conspiracists, whose chief characteristic is a belief that Oswald was innocent, that it was all frame, that it was a huge conspiracy involving various elements of the American establishment. And of course, the most famous representative of that theory, who spread it most widely, is my contemporary Oliver Stone.
One of the fascinating things about the Oliver Stone movie, and I admired it in many, many ways, but was the line in there that this was a murder that makes Hamlet of all of us. Hamlet, after all, is the story about the killing of his father, as indeed they killed the father figure of our generation in America. And in both cases, they wanted to leave us hanging. In this country, it's been a sort of mental torture that's gone on nearly 50 years. And I keep wondering why. Are we getting closer to a real answer?
Well, that's a very complicated question. The tendency of the men in charge of the U.S. government in 1963 and 64 was to take the simplest explanation and put this behind us as quickly as possible. That was the kind of men they were. The GI generation was very good at many things, but introspection wasn't one of them. Mm. Meanwhile, Lyndon Johnson was very worried by what seemed to him to be the most likely conspiracy scenario, namely that Fidel Castro and perhaps the Soviets were behind it. And it is quite clear that he more or less – well, that he asked Earl Warren to put that to bed, something that Warren didn't mind doing. Now, the thing that
– the cover-up begins right there in a way.
I would not call it a cover-up, because a cover-up to me means – people know the truth, and they're going to make sure you don't know it. Mm. Now, they didn't know the truth. Now, David Talbot published a book last year with which I have some differences, but in many ways it's a very interesting book. And one of the things he was able to show was that hardly any of the leading figures in Washington actually believed the Warren Commission. But that doesn't mean they knew the truth. They didn't. They just had a lot of doubts of their own. But they weren't the kind of men who would linger over that. Now, other things that have made it hard to know the truth. We wasted a lot of time and energy because some of the basic conclusions of the Warren Commission, yes, didn't look likely. If you watch the Zapruder film, yes, it looks like the president got hit from the front. I don't think he was, but that's a reasonable conclusion to draw from the film. The single bullet theory, which was key to its findings, the belief that one bullet hit Connally and Kennedy, doesn't sound in many ways very likely. For one thing, Connally himself, up to the end of his life, said, no, that didn't happen. I realized the president was hit, and then I was hit. My feeling, though, is that the House Committee proved that it was true, that it did happen, and that's what the evidence of the bullets and bullet fragments proves, too. in my judgment, and Connolly was suffering from an intense denial reaction that lasted about a few seconds until he realized that a bullet had passed through his body. And as someone who has a pretty strong denial reaction to traumatic events myself, I can perfectly well believe that.
Right.
So a lot of energy, thousands of pages of books were spilled over those issues. And now the thing is, Chris, you're asking me again and again, are we getting closer to the truth? Well, I've written several books on controversial subjects. I co-authored one on Sacco and Vanzetti. I wrote one on the origins of the Vietnam War. I've been a historian all my life. As I say many times, there's a market for truth out there, but it's what we call a specialty market.
To me, it's a fascinating question as to why people fall on either side of the line. And some people like Norman Mailer,
yes,
cries it back and forth. I.F. Stone, who was my notion of the greatest journalist of our time, believed the single assassin theory just because, as he said, he couldn't imagine that Earl Warren would be in on a shoddy job. Arthur Schlesinger, a court historian, took the rather adventurous view in the Kennedy circle that no, the conspiracy theory was plausible, and so it goes. I must say, I have always tried to see the case through Robert Kennedy's eyes, because his eyes saw everything. He was famous for knowing exactly what was going on in every precinct of the country and every corner of his brother's government. And when I think about his remorse, I'm always confounded and sometimes furious that he never said what he knew. He knew all about Operation Mongoose. He ran it, in effect, to assassinate Castro. He certainly knew about his brother's girls. He knew about the CIA effort. He knew everything about the mob. I mean, the girlfriends that the president shared with Sam Giancana and Robert Kennedy's own relentless pursuit of Sam Giancana. He knew where all the bombs were in the room and never spoke about it.
Well, it is clear that Robert Kennedy had suspicions. And I think that's why Arthur Schlesinger, as you mentioned, had suspicions, because Robert Kennedy voiced them to him. And you can read about that now in Schlesinger's journal, although that material was already in the biography Schlesinger did. But two things. That he had suspicions doesn't mean that he actually knew what had happened. I don't think he did. He knew there was a lot of explosive information out there. And he was also, above all, a political animal whose main priority, I think almost from within months after his brother was killed, was to get back into power, which is why he began
to retake the hill and get even, probably.
Well, I don't know about that, but at any rate, to get back into power. Now, let's take a parallel case. The general wiretapping that was done by the Kennedy Justice Department, which becomes known in the mid-60s, in I think 66 or 67. And that may have included something about Martin Luther King, but I have to check. But at any rate, there was a wiretapping controversy. And he immediately denies he had anything to do with it. Well, that was nonsense. I mean, he knew all about it. He was getting reports on his desk based on wiretaps frequently, and he loved it, from mobsters we're talking about now. Now, it's the same way. Robert Kennedy, as I remember it, on the afternoon of the 22nd, had the presence of mind to say, we want the autopsy to be in Washington. We don't want a full autopsy in Dallas.
Mm.
Because he and his brother had denied again and again that John Kennedy had Addison's disease, which he did, and it wouldn't look good to have that come out. So you have somebody who, yes, wants to know, but who also wants to protect himself, reputation, and doesn't know what will go where. The other thing I would say, though, is, and this goes to the Warren Commission, the senators on the Church Committee, and the congressmen on the House Assassinations Committee, many of whom wanted to do a good job, and some of them, Richard Schweiker, Gary Hart, got very interested in certain aspects of the case. But a senator or congressman, an elected politician, simply can't sit down for hours every day for a few months with the kind of concentration that it takes to really get into something like that. That's what we have historians for, or congressional staffers who tend to be attorneys, many of whom also can be quite good at this.
Well, in the meantime, my respect for Robert Kennedy is challenged by the fact that when his brother was killed, he didn't say, "Ladies and gentlemen, my fellow Americans, we have to talk. And we have to talk about what our government has actually been working on, doing with these very elements you're talking about. A war on the mob that embraced the mob. A war on Fidel Castro that may just yesterday have exploded in our face. This is serious, and we've got to get real here."
I've got to dispute the characterization, the war on the mob that embraced the mob. Robert Kennedy never embraced the mob in any way, shape, or form, except perhaps by being naive about certain third parties. For instance, accepting some help and financial help through Frank Sinatra in the 1960 campaign, which it is very clear included a contribution from Sam Giancana of Chicago that Sinatra delivered. I doubt very much that Sinatra told anybody in the Kennedy campaign who that money was from. And when Sinatra tried to take advantage of that after the election to get some heat off of Giancana, he was completely disappointed. I also think that there's no doubt that Robert Kennedy, when he discovered the mob plot against Castro, ordered that it be turned off and thought it had been turned off. But it was carried on surreptitiously by William Harvey and Richard Helms and the CIA without even telling the director of the CIA, much less Robert Kennedy or the White House.
I was thinking about your assertion late in the book,
yes,
David, and you attribute it to Robert Blakey and Richard Billings, but their speculation in the 1970s that John Kennedy, because he accepted women as favors through Frank Sinatra, had lost the immunity from retaliation that truly incorruptible public officials generally enjoyed. In other words,
that's true.
That's
yes.
Somebody embraced somebody there, and whether Robert Kennedy, waived it or not. All I mean to say is that what I really mean to say is that it struck me from the Kennedy family, we're still waiting for a truly realistic account of their brother and our hero to explain this man.
Robert, you mean?
Well, Robert initially, even Robert's children, Robert's wife. There is so much running through the whole story. There is so much guilty knowledge, shall we say.
Well, there are some tantalizing hints in the sources. And again, I'm being very careful to distinguish what I found from the things that we've been hearing for 30 years, seeing on television and documentaries and so on, that have been gotten way out of hand about the father, about Joe Kennedy. For instance, Johnny Roselli, a henchman of Sam Giancana of Chicago, and Johnny Roselli was the main CIA contact in dealing with the mob, was having a conversation with Sinatra in 1962, in which they were bemoaning the fact that Sinatra was not successful in getting the heat taken off of Giancana. And Roselli, as he reported to Giancana, Roselli said to Sinatra, "I think you ought to call old Joe." And Sinatra replied, "No, the kids don't listen to him." Now, what was that about? I don't know. I'd certainly like to know. But that was what I was not able to run down.
You're thinking, of course, as a historian, and you're looking at evidence the way lawyers do, too. I keep thinking in terms of just a country and myself as a citizen that wants to know who killed Daddy. This is the Hamlet question. And it seems to me there's an urgency in that that's been ignored all these years.
Well, I think that's why, frankly, we're sitting here having this conversation. And let me.
It's why I read your book so thoroughly and with great admiration, David.
It's also why I wrote it. But let me explain that with another step, because it's only in the last year that I realized this, although it's really quite obvious in retrospect. The last book I wrote was called American Tragedy, Kennedy, Johnson, and the Origins of the Vietnam War. And I sat down around 1990 and then said, I'm going to figure out how we got into Vietnam. And that book took 10 years to write and get out. Now, I really wasn't sure what I would find at the beginning. I wasn't sure where my opinion of John Kennedy would come out there. But I felt the evidence was overwhelming by the time I got to the end of that book that Kennedy had been asked to go into Vietnam in the same way as Johnson was, by the same people, repeatedly in 1961 and also into Laos, and he had refused. And he had made it clear again and again, this is a bad idea. This is not a good place to fight. He had gone in a different direction in Laos. And I was convinced by the end of the book that had he lived, we would not have gone into Vietnam. That is so. What has occurred to me is that having reached that conclusion, there was a certain logic to my devoting the next 7 years of my life to working on exactly why he died. Since the decision to go into Vietnam in 1965, when I was 18, turned out to be the end of an era in American history. And in fact, American tragedy, I now realize, is in a way it's a love letter to an age of innocence, which ended at that moment, about which I was quite explicit at the end of the book. Now, I don't think that Vietnam, per se, had anything to do with the assassination of the president. Cuba did. Actually, that is a great irony, and the story is filled with irony, because to the extent that Cuba played a role, which is hard to tell, but it probably played some role, it was because certain people didn't think Kennedy was going to overthrow Castro. Now, in fact, I was sad to find this, but I did find it, that President Kennedy and his administration remained quite determined to overthrow Castro right up until his last day in office.
We've been talking a lot about the peculiar magnetism of Cuba. Mm-hmm. Then and now, going back to the 19th century, the Spanish-American War, Fidel Castro himself. Do you have a notion of why this incredible grip of Cuba on the minds of the Kennedy brothers? Was it strategy? Was it macho? Was it a football game? What was it all about?
It was all those things. It was a macho game, particularly for Robert Kennedy, who expressed himself violently on the subject after the Bay of Pigs. I mean, Castro had made them look silly, and they were going to get back at him. It was partly politics. There's a very interesting memo written by a smart CIA guy. I think it's in November of 62. In other words, it's right after the missile crisis and right after the congressional elections, in which the Democrats had done well. And he says, well, now we can see this pretty clearly. After the Bay of Pigs, they put the heat on us about Castro because they were worried about the election. But now that's over with, and with the missile crisis, we're promising not to invade Cuba. So now we can go back to normal. Now, ironically, that lasted about 3 or 4 months, and then there were some incidents that put the issue on the table again in a high-level meeting in about, I think it's April of 63. Robert Kennedy says, well, let's do a survey of what we could do against Castro in the next 18 months. Well, do the math. There's another election coming up then. And they crank it up again. And again, they are playing with scenarios all through 1963 that involve Castro's assassination. Because what they had decided was, well, we have a pledge not to invade Cuba, but if there's some kind of a coup in Cuba, right, if there's some violent action that creates some chaos in Cuba, we're absolved of our pledge. So let's see if we can make that happen.
And an assassination is not an invasion.
No.
A little bit like it could, Bill Clinton saying what he did with Monica Lewinsky wasn't sex.
Well, the weird distinction that comes up again and again is a distinction which is difficult to understand between a pure assassination. In other words, you just want person X dead, so you kill
poison
him.
His drink or his cigar.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the death of the leader in the course of some kind of a coup. Now, that's different for some reason. Now the thing is, President Kennedy was very coy about this, as he could be. And twice, with people he liked, including one fairly close personal friend, he brought up the possibility of assassinating Castro. But he did it in a very coy way, and the second time when the reporter, Tad Schultz, said, I think that would be terrible, Kennedy did what he often did. I mean, he was a brilliant politician. He said, oh, of course, I agree with you.
Right.
But then, to my shock, at the Kennedy Library just a couple of years ago, I was reading about a conference that Kennedy had with Central American presidents in March of 1963. And he was having a conversation with the president of Guatemala, and he said more or less spontaneously, well, Castro was such a charismatic figure that his sudden death could very well have an extraordinary effect on the situation. And I thought, oh, my.
David Kaiser, to me, the hero of your book, who pops out in the middle, is a man I'd almost forgotten, William Atwood.
Oh, yes.
He'd worked for Look magazine. He became a diplomat. Interesting character, and he had the odd notion in the Kennedy time of normalizing relations with Castro. He had one interesting conversation.
Yes.
Came back with the suggestions that Castro was wide open to a different sort of relationship, even that if the United States would lift the economic blockade of Cuba, he, Castro, would evict the Soviets from his island. Now, the astonishing thing in your book is that nobody in Washington liked that idea at all.
Well, it's interesting that you saw that because, well, as I think I said...
Well, it jumps out. This is an honest and constructive American looking for a
Well, he also happened solution. To be a personal friend and for a time almost like a second father. He was the ambassador to Guinea under Kennedy from 61 to 63. My father was the ambassador to Senegal up the coast.
My word.
In 61, they were both at an ambassador's conference, I think in Nigeria, and Atwood got a mild case of polio. He was flown to Dakar, where we lived, where the best medical care in the region was. That was the first of a series of contacts between our families. And he was really a great man. Now, the thing is...
This is astonishing.
He knew Castro. His previous career had been as a journalist. This was one of the great things that Kennedy did. Kennedy appointed about 20 non-diplomatic people as ambassadors, but they weren't wealthy contributors. There were people like Atwood who had been journalists in foreign affairs, or like Ken Galbraith, or like General Gavin, the retired general, or like my father, who had some diplomatic experience of another sort. And Atwood had interviewed Castro at great length in 1959. In addition, this I never heard from him, although I've his wife, who was still his widow, was still alive. She was somewhat younger than him. She's a wonderful woman, too. She remembers this. They were at a party in Havana sometime in the summer of 1959. And it included some wealthy Cubans and some Americans who were supposed to be in the CIA. And as Atwood told the church committee, he was informed that the contract was out on Fidel, that Fidel wasn't going to live out the year, and in fact that two CIA men of the party were going to kill him or were part of the plot. So that was an interesting piece of information, too. Atwood was a Stevenson man. He was working for Stevenson at the UN. He was between ambassadorial assignments. He struck up conversations about this eventually with some of the Cubans at the UN, and he floated it. And again, a lot of people have jumped on this as proof that Kennedy wanted to change the policy. Now, unfortunately, again, the published documents show that when Bill floated it to Washington, McGeorge Bundy, as he explains, talked it over with the president. And they said, no, not now. And when it came up at a high-level discussion, Robert Kennedy, sounding in this instance, I regret to say, a little bit like the current administration, said, Castro has to understand that if we're ever going to have relations with him, there have to be deep, fundamental changes in his behavior on a number of issues. So, unfortunately, it was not going to go anywhere yet.
And you write that the upshot of that high-level meeting under McGeorge Bundy with Attorney General Robert Kennedy and others, Cy Vance from Defense and more, was that it would be better for William Atwood to return to private life before meeting again with Fidel Castro.
That's right.
the rejection at the highest levels of the Kennedy administration of any rapprochement, even conversation with Castro, just seems to me one of those blazing ironies that we don't hear enough about. I mean, this was an initiative that might have changed hemispheric relations, might well have saved the life of President Kennedy. Robert Kennedy, in turn, would be living in a different world if that conversation had started. No?
I don't see how it could have saved the life of President Kennedy, no. But I think because the men who wanted to kill him would not have been pleased by any attempt to normalize relations with Castro, on the contrary. But here's what I think, and this is also clear from the documents. I've spent years, literally, living intimately inside the Kennedy and Johnson administrations by reading their documents. That's what being a serious research historian means. And that happens to be something that I'm in love with doing, and there are a few people like that, and we're the ones who write these books. But anyway, the president, Kennedy, was above all a politician. He was a great politician. And he didn't like to get out ahead of public opinion. And he frequently will remark about one thing or another, well, there may come a time for that, but it's not yet. Now, here he is in late 1963. The big domestic crisis in the country is civil rights. He's worried he's going to lose the whole South. In fact, that's why he made the trip to Texas, among other things, as he said specifically in a press conference. He was very anxious to carry Texas again. And it's beginning to look as if the Republican candidate might be Barry Goldwater. Now, Robert Kennedy, in a very funny, moving moment in the oral history he did a year or two later, said, we almost didn't dare hope it would be Goldwater because we were sure he would self-destruct, but in November we were terrified that he would self-destruct before he got nominated. So, ironically, said the man they were really worried about was George Romney. But Goldwater, if it is him, or if it's Richard Nixon, which certainly looked possible, they're going to be hammering on soft on communism issues. So the time to think about normalizing relations with Castro, if at all, is after the election, not now. Let's not get out ahead of this.
What's your judgment of President Kennedy as a man, as a single figure at the end of all this? And maybe I'll just stick my own neck out. He seems to me the most compartmentalized human being that I've ever imagined or read about in fact or fiction.
He is a remarkably compartmentalized human being. He has remarkable presence of mind. He shows, especially in the missile crisis, where you can follow it minute by minute in the transcripts, in the Kennedy tapes, he really shows what Clausewitz, a man whom I teach, called military genius. Hmm. Namely, to keep your head in the midst of chaos, to keep your mind focused on the critical point. And my old advisor, Ernest May, was one of the editors of the Kennedy tapes, and I remember hearing him interviewed about it. And he said, and he's absolutely right, these are the best and the brightest, and consistently in these conversations, Kennedy is two jumps ahead of everybody else. Mm. I mean, he knows where it's coming. He was very compartmentalized. And for instance, the whole issue of his womanizing. Yes, it's true. And indeed, when you read the White House appointment calendar, you can see it. But it's very interesting. He gets to the office between 8:30 and 9. He works all morning till noon or 1. And then for about 2 or 3 hours, he disappears. And then he comes back at 3 or 4, and he works for 2 or 3 more hours. Then he goes to dinner. He goes away for the weekends. He's really living, for a president, a relatively sane life, a far saner life than either of his two successors, Johnson and Nixon. And he is very cool. He is quite unemotional. In fact,
he's also suffering rather severe ups and downs of Addison's disease.
No, actually, from everything I can see, the Addison's disease was pretty well under control. Now, what he had a terrible time with in the first year in office was his back. And that was not helped because his doctor put him on narcotic painkillers for that. And late in the year, this has been discussed in Herbert Parmet's book and I think in Bob Dalek's book, he got new medical advice and they said, no, this is terrible. We're going to turn him into an addict. And they took him off that and gave him physical therapy. And his health was doing much better. And the cortisone he was getting apparently was really doing the job as far as the Addison's disease went.
The other thing that leaps out of your book, David, is the astonishing multiplicity of plots and people who were ready to kill somebody at the drop of a hat. Not just, you know, Carlos Marcello and Sandro Trafficante and John Rosselli and Sam Giancana, but a whole variety of Cuban politicians who were scheming killings of one sort or another. And then a broad array of CIA folk with great names like Desmond Fitzgerald, father of Frankie, and David Attlee Phillips and Howard Hunt and Edward Lansdale, who had nothing but killing on their mind. It was sort of...
I wouldn't say nothing.
Well, it's astonishing, though. We think of this as a bloody-minded era, but that was incredible.
Well, it was, and it was started off under the Eisenhower administration, which, as the Church Committee found, and I summarized their foundings, found not one plot, but three. One against Patrice Lumumba, about which they talked much more bluntly than about Castro. Mm. One against Rafael Trujillo. Now, Lumumba was killed, but according to the best information available, he was killed when Eisenhower was still president, but he was killed by his own enemies, not by this man the CIA had gotten to recruit him. Lots of people wanted to kill Lumumba, undoubtedly. And Trujillo was killed in April of 1961. And in fact, I have to wonder whether that encouraged the CIA to continue with the plots against Castro and even encouraged the Kennedy administration to continue. I mean, they'd done it once. They'd gotten away with it. Mm-hmm. So why not? There's a bizarre aspect to this because it actually comes up, I think, in 59 or in 60, when they're mounting these plots that, well, you know, Trujillo's right wing. He's been the dictator of Dominican Republic for 30 years. He's killed an American citizen in the U.S. who was an opponent of his. But if we kill him, too, as well as Castro, then we're sort of equal opportunity killers. You know, it's not just that we kill left-wing people. We can kill right-wing people, too, if they're bad enough. So it won't upset people that much if Castro was assassinated, if Trujillo was assassinated, too. But they really believed in the war aspect of the Cold War. I think they had gotten carried away. Now, the terrible thing about this with respect to Cuba is the point on which I decided to end the book, that Cuba and the United States have had such intense relations for over a century. In a sense, it's almost a father-son relationship. I mean, we did help bring about the independence of Cuba.
Man and mistress, perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, well, then we took away the independence of Cuba, in effect, by reserving the right to interfere in their affairs. Cuban and American life were so intertwined in so many ways for the first half of the century. You know, you had the Dodgers training in Havana, Hemingway writing many of his books in, at least one, about Cuba. Mm. Miami, the Las Vegas of the East. Movies like Guys and Dolls that I mentioned. And now...
The mumbo craze that we grew up in.
Sure. But now, because we couldn't accept that the Cubans would pick a leader and a system opposed to us, we have had this, in my opinion, tragic and useless no war, no peace situation now for almost 50 years, which has benefited no one, in my judgment, least of all the Cuban people themselves. And there's a lot about this we don't understand. I will never forget this. That 30 years ago at Harvard, when I was an assistant professor, I was talking to a Cuban. No, I'm sorry, not a Cuban, a Colombian. He was a Colombian politician, but he'd been educated at Exeter and Harvard, and he was back for a year at the Kennedy School. He spoke English better than any of the Americans I knew. And we were talking about world politics in general and about American foreign policy. And I said to him, do you think we should have intervened against Castro? He said, of course not. He says, David, I like Castro. He says, David, you have to understand that for Latin Americans, Castro is right up there with Simon Bolivar. And I thought for a second, and I said, I'll paraphrase, you mean because he said screw you to the United States and got away with it? Absolutely, he said. And we've never wanted to understand this. And we still can't put this to bed. And I really am looking forward to the day when Cuba and the United States have a normal relationship again.
David Kaiser, this is so interesting, and I want to thank you very much. But one last word, please, as to how you imagine this story, a complicated narrative of two great passions in America intersecting and exploding in the 1960s, a war on crime that was highly compromised and a war against Cuba that was defective from the root. How do you see that saga answering the big question about how we lost President Kennedy? Do we have a master narrative, a governing myth that can let us get on with things?
Well, what I said was that this came out of two zones of illegality. And both of them say something about how Americans see themselves and see themselves in relation to the world. We have organized crime in this country because we believe that certain appetites should be outlawed. Sex for pay, which is in the news again. Illegal drugs, gambling. These things shouldn't be happening, we feel. But inevitably, they're going to happen. And by outlawing them, we create an illegal zone where lawlessness rules, literally. And that was the organized crime piece, which Robert Kennedy, with a crusading spirit, even though he was no saint himself, took on the task of ridding America of, as he put it in his own bestseller, the enemy within. And then similarly, almost, in our mood at that moment, which again is paralleled in the administration today on other issues, we decided that communist nations in the Western Hemisphere simply shouldn't be allowed to exist. And anything goes to make that happen. What fascinates me is that our founding fathers really weren't men like that who saw the world like that. They were almost the opposite. They felt that they had grown up under the British Constitution, the most perfect constitution in the world, and they had seen it go wrong from their point of view. They had seen it mutated into tyranny. So they embarked upon the task of reducing the chances that that would happen to the maximum extent possible. But we have these periodic bursts of idealism, of perfectibility. We have this abiding sense of our own uniqueness and of what we should and should not tolerate. And it gets us into trouble in lots and lots of ways. And I think this was one of them. However, to quote Clausewitz again, and maybe this is the hardest thing for us to accept, chance plays a big role in war, in life, in history. And there was a lot of that involved in this, too.
Thank you, David Kaiser, and thank you for this monumentally interesting book, The Road to Dallas, The Assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's been a great pleasure being here.
Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation for Open Source at the Watson Institute at Brown University. Please join this ongoing conversation about Cuba and books and ideas and cabbages and kings on our website at www.radioopensource.org. Write me directly by email, if you will, at chris@radioopensource.org. Thank you for being a part of the community of the curious and the expressive at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon.